The Guardian.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just this old bigoted woman that said she used to be a lady.
Hello, this is Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. On this week's podcast, Bigotgate, Duffygate, call it what you will, but a tiny little radio mic has captured what some are calling the turning point of this election.
It's a disaster. Well, just should never have put me with that woman. Whose idea was that?
I don't know, I
didn't see. It's Sue, I think.
Thrust into the spotlight, Britain's Joe the Plumber, the most famous 65-year-old from Rochdale.
He described you as a very bigoted woman. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Why has he said that? He doesn't know me.
You were a fan of the Prime Minister.
Yes, I like Gordon Brett, yes. I was going for a loaf of bread.
But should it even have been reported? And what's the media fallout? Plus, we take a general look at the election coverage so far and what to expect for the big night. Also, why is the Wall Street Journal going head-to-head with the New York Times? And...
Like New Orleans. Enjoy with care. Drink responsibly. Absolute Radio. Discover real music.
The trademark battle is over. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. In the studio today, we have a top team of unbiased and unbigoted commentators. Emily Bell, The Guardian's soon-to-be ex-director of digital content, is here for the second week in a row. Is it because all your important meetings have been cancelled?
Yes, I have been disinvited from even from my own meetings.
So
all I can do is hang out up here with you. If you want me on Science Weekly, I'm also available for that. And politics.
Have you sorted out your curtains?
I've spent actually most of last night worrying about whether or not I could stand a tumble dryer on top of a washing machine. That's my new life.
I love moving. Media Guardian's John Plunkett is also here. And you're never a man to be caught unawares with a live microphone, are you?
I'd like to bet £500 on... Oh, sorry, I'm just chatting to my bookmaker. No, certainly not, Matt.
Very good. I expect you missed it, as it didn't get much airplay. There was a minor story involving the Prime Minister and a voter somewhere in the north of England this week. Yes, it's Bigotgate, and it all happened when the PM was trying to drum up support in Rochdale, a constituency that Labour lost to the Lib Dems by 442 votes last time around. It was all going so well until he bumped into Gillian Duffy, a 65-year-old pensioner who had popped out to get a loaf of bread but ended up getting the Prime Minister into a bit of a jam. This piece of audio has been replayed endlessly, but let's play it again for the purposes of setting up this item.
6 months.
Say anything about the immigrants because you're saying that you're
no.
But all these Eastern Europeans what are coming in, where are they flocking from?
A million people come from Europe, but a million people, British people, have gone into Europe. You do know there's a lot of British people staying in Europe as well. Look, come back to what you were, your initial principles, helping people. That's what we're in the business of doing. A decent health service, that's really important. And education. Education, health, and helping people. That's what I'm about. That's what I'm about.
Well,
you've had the chance.
It's been very good
to meet you.
Yeah,
it's been very
nice
good to meet you.
Yeah.
And you're wearing the right colour today. Now, how many grandchildren do you have?
Two. Only 12 and 10.
Oh, they're only 12 and 10.
Yeah,
but they're doing well at school.
Yeah, very good.
A good family.
Yeah,
good to see you.
And the education system in Rochdale, I will congratulate it.
Good. And it's very nice to see you. Take care.
Thanks, Gordon.
Good to see you all. Good to see you. Thanks very much. That's a disaster. Well, okay. Should never have put me with that woman. Whose idea was that?
I don't know, I didn't see.
It's Sue, I think.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman that said she used to be a lady.
Oh dear, poor old Sue. It doesn't get any worse on the replaying, does it? It has to be said.
That's what you say when you're off mic.
Anyway, then, as we heard, the radio mic cut out as the car drove off. I wonder what else he said that we didn't hear. Then the reactions came, first from Gillian and then a visibly horrified Gordon Brown on Radio 2.
And when he got into the car...
What did he say?
Well... You might not like this, but he said, what a disaster. Who got me to talk to that woman? She's a bigot. Or words to that effect. And we want to know your response to that.
You're joking.
But we wondered whether we can talk to you a bit more about it. And just find out your
Tasha
reaction.
Said that, has he?
Oh, clever thing. She just looks like a bigoted woman.
Well, what do you think about that, Mrs. Duffy?
Disgusted.
Now, you said to me before that you were... a Labour supporter. I mean,
yes.
What's this done to that?
I don't think I'll vote
I don't think I'll vote now. It's a postal vote and I don't have to send it in anyhow now.
Someone has just handed me the tape. Let's play it and see if we can hear it.
She never put me with that woman. Whose idea was that?
No, I didn't see her.
That's Sue, I think.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman. Said she used to be a lady. I mean, it's so ridiculous.
That is what you said. Is she not allowed to express her view to you?
Of course she's allowed to express her view, and I was saying that. The problem was that I was dealing with a question that she raised about immigration, and I wasn't given a chance to answer it because we had a whole melee of press around her. But of course I apologise if I've ever said anything that has been offensive, and I would never put myself in a position where I would want to say anything like that about a woman I met.
So where to begin with this? I don't know. Well, one of the most extraordinary things, Emily, was how Sky News had a picture of a white UPVC front door for about an hour.
I feel very sorry for Gordon Brown in this because I think we've all been there. There's a colleague stopped me on the stairs and reminded me that we used to have a phrase between us, which was words in car. Which is, you know, when you've been in a slightly tense situation, either socially or at work, you know, or whatever, and something doesn't quite go right. And we used to occasionally say, "Oh, there'll be words in car about that." Words in car don't count. But it was a perfect story. I have to commend the news channels, particularly the Sky News, who had it was almost like Groundhog Day. Was she going to come out or not? Yes. And actually, the sort of the tragicomedy around it built throughout the day, and then poor old Gordon had to go in, and then came out, and she wouldn't come out. You know, it really was like, you know, where's Punk's Tawny Phil? Is it going to rain for 40 days or not? And it played again on, I think, the news at 10, where I have to sort of congratulate Nick Robinson for an absolutely masterful piece of pure sort of, you know, restrained but very, very, very comic reporting. And you can't, I mean, what a disaster.
I know.
What a disaster. And schoolboy error.
What?
Schoolboy error.
Schoolboy error. Just, I know, with the microphone. So John, the amazing thing about it, I think, is how it blew up so quickly, and the noise and the volume of the commentary and the reaction and it being all over the papers and all over the news channels, and all so quickly.
Yeah, I think it's because you had the audio, and it was a brilliant radio story, and it's a brilliant TV story. It was a classic one for the breaking news channels, wasn't it? For 24-hour news channels.
Did you read the producer's blog?
I did, John? At Sky News. Yeah, they didn't undersell it. Possibly. Yeah, this was a blog post by the Sky News producer, who's Tammy Hoffman, and she gives a little sort of a rundown of the events of the day, and says at the end, watching Gordon Brown arrive later to apologise at Gillian Duffy's house in Rochdale, I swear I felt the hand of history on my shoulder.
I should point out that she's the person who actually spotted the fact that, because it wasn't carried live, and it was only when they were going back through it later that it was spotted.
And she said she noticed the unusual body language of Gordon Brown, which is quite a good spot to spot. And then she turned up the volume and heard what we heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think the media, I mean, a lot of people are saying, Emily, that the media completely overblew it, overplayed it, and it's all our fault. You're shaking your head.
You know, as I say, did we overplay it? Not really. I don't think the Prime Minister called a pensioner who votes for him a bigot.
Yeah.
Yes, he did it in private.
I think you'll find the BBC producer guidelines against it.
Well, I mean, it's just, as I say, it's just the product of a very tense situation, and it is a gaffe. And after, John Major and the John Snow interview on Channel, I think that was sort of Channel 4 News, kind of, yes, whatever it was in the 97 election, it was actually, Bastardgate.
Yeah, where, I think it was Michael Brunson of ITN.
Oh, Michael Brunson, okay, well, he described his colleagues as bastards, which, again, I mean, and there are certain things, oddly, actually, sort of Gordon did rather well out of allegedly punching his staff, I think, because most of the country probably felt they'd quite like to punch them too. But, you know, she seemed like, you know, actually, as though her concerns were legitimate.
Yes.
You might not agree with them, but she's gone, and I thought also kind of the fact that she seemed genuinely sort of shocked and upset and hurt. You know, she'd been sort of put into this kind of media circus. I mean, if anything, you know, it's really sort of towards her that there's a sort of slight duty of care, which she's perhaps failed in.
When the news team asked her, you know, do you want to know what Gordon said about you? The look of anticipation and excitement on her face was meant, oh, really? What did he say? And then her reaction was, oh, no. I mean, I didn't think it was that disastrous. I mean, if the audio hadn't been picked up, I wouldn't have imagined that would have made that interview would surely not have made a news story, would it?
No, I mean, the thing was, I think that and maybe that's where you see a little bit again of the sort of the character, the sort of deep
paranoia.
You know, the deep sort of character sort of issues that Brown has, because actually it went off reasonably well. She turned around at the end and congratulated him
and warmly
on the school system. Well, of Rochdale. Doesn't that happen every day?
There is a rumour. There is a rumour because, you know, Gordon Brown has been saying that he sort of misheard her and he misunderstood her. If you recall, what she said was, you know, about Eastern Europeans, where are they flocking from? Now, if you could slightly mishear that, where are they flocking from? Where are they flocking from?
Right.
He thought that she had sworn, you see, and that had got him angry, that she was more bigoted than perhaps she appeared.
I don't buy that because I think his reaction afterwards as she was walking off was sort of to sort of trail her down the street asking her about her grandchildren. I think if she'd dropped the F-bomb, I think the Prime Minister would have been well within his rights to step back. And, you know, it just I can see a spin doctor. I mean, can I just say the other thing about this, which I think has really helped, is just the thick of it factor. It is completely meta in terms of political sitcom, and the real Malcolm Tucker was tweeting yesterday. Yes. I've had to send a junior minister to Milton Keynes to call Esther Ranson a so to take some of the heat off.
Am I allowed to say that? Of course you are. Yes, you're allowed to say anything on the internet. And
Armando Iannucci went on as well on Twitter to give his verdict and said it was sad and hilarious at the same time, like the death of Eugene Terreblanche.
Yes,
that was his take.
I mean, the other thing, of course, is that it sort of played into the whole narrative, John, of Gordon Brown, in that we had never previously had an actual physical audio video evidence of what he was like, and the spin doctors had been able to portray all that stuff that in the Andrew Rawnsley book as, oh, you know, he's just passionate, he's strong-willed, and now for the first time we've had actual documented evidence of what he's like.
Yes, it's been seized upon to say, well, the spin doctor said this wasn't true, and now we have sort of firm evidence. But I mean, it's a one-off, and in itself, it's calling a woman a bigot. It's relatively minor, isn't it? But as you say, it backs up, seems to justify what people have said about him before.
Yeah,
I think it also sort of, there is something about the heart of modern politics, and I think it particularly sort of chimes badly with the Labour Party, that I think people do genuinely get the sense, and actually I don't think this has been true of Gordon Brown before, but that a lot of people around Gordon Brown and a lot of people around Tony Blair, they don't actually like people very much. You know, that there is something about modern politics which is actually about, you know, you don't really sort of connect with the public. And I think why this is particularly damaging for Gordon Brown, because I think people have seen him as being potentially quite sort of passionate and difficult with his staff, but he's had a sort of reputation for being able to do what they call in politics a small room quite well, that actually being, you know, he comes across in a one-to-one situation as more kind of relaxed and slightly more engaging and charming than he ever looks on television. And he has a reputation for being, you know, very sort of distributive in terms of his policies, in terms of social justice, and actually sort of was one of those rare politicians who actually, you know, you can almost sort of see some of the other new Labourites kind of washing their hands. So I think for him that's why this is such a catastrophe.
The other thing that is slightly unsightly and slightly may play against Mrs. Duffy, however, is the fact that Bell Pottinger Public Relations pitched up on her doorstep and are now representing her.
You can't really, as I say, she was sort of thrust into this situation by poor old Sue Nye, who's the other person who's kind of in this, who I don't suppose really gives two hoots whether Gordon thought it was a disaster or not, sort of, you know. But I think that, you know, yes, I mean, the immediate, and she's hired a public relations agency, but then we don't know what went on in that conversation. We don't know how they offered their services. You know, we don't know what they promised her.
Apparently, I do hear, because I understand from, because apparently someone from Bell Pottinger follows me on Twitter, and when I expressed outrage about this last night, I was I was corrected very quickly, which is that her daughter, Belle Pottinger, is connected to a client of her daughter's, or there's some connection with Belle Pottinger and her daughter, and that's why, and her daughter called them for help.
Well, Belle Pottinger have been on Twitter. Somebody from Belle Pottinger was on Twitter allegedly saying, or somebody who is allegedly from Belle Pottinger was definitely on Twitter saying the most disastrous Tory campaign ever, and they need some of the big guns in there. So I don't know whether this is also a sort of an opportunistic moment to get.
Apparently, also the Sun did conduct an interview with Mrs. Duffy, but didn't print it because she didn't slag off Gordon Brown strongly enough. There we are. Very good. Well, anyway, that's it on that. We'll leave it up there. We'll come back to the election in a bit. But for everything you need to know on that story, go to mediaguardian.co.uk and of course guardian.co.uk. UK/politics.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Let's take a look at some of the other media stories making the headlines this week. First, there's a bit of a sort of clash between Rupert Murdoch and Arthur Sulzberger, the owners of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. We've included this item just for you, Emily, because we know that this is...
Rupert Murdoch upsetting other first competitive press owners. It's like, you know, it's a change. Ever since Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal, which I think is now, 2 years ago, he has been really sort of setting it at, it's always been sort of a very, you know, pure play financial newspaper. And he's been, he has traditionally competed with the Financial Times and pretty much nobody else. When Murdoch took it over, he already owns the New York Daily News, and he was wanting to orient the Wall Street Journal at the New York Times. Now, this goes back to a sort of a very, very sort of historic story about, I think, Rupert Murdoch possibly meeting, you know, Arthur Sulzberger's grandfather, whatever, when he must be 19. Grandfather, when he was a 19-year-old student, and about how this sort of left a kind of a deep and lasting impression on him, and how he's had incredible kind of, you know, envy as the world's greatest newspaper baron. He's never owned
the world's greatest newspaper.
And what's more, the family trust, unlike the sort of the bid for Dow Jones, did not bend or wouldn't have bent to Murdoch's will. So I think he's
never going to get it.
So the next thing is pointing the journal fairly and squarely at the New York Times, which obviously means it's having to do lots of things that it wouldn't have ever considered doing before, including
the sport and the arts and the culture.
The sport, the arts. Well, it's always had a little bit of that sort of tucked away on page B57 or whatever, but it's making it much more kind of, you know, competitive mainstream, and particularly around the metro area coverage of New York.
Well, they've launched a new 12-page section.
They have indeed, where you can read about the difficulties of getting onto the subway with your card. You know, so I think local journalism there as here is obviously, you know, sort of a very vital and important part of the local culture, but it can also sort of stray into the slightly mundane. So they've been having a right old scrap. They've been poaching people from the New York Times, and the New York Times have in some cases been poaching them back. And so it's a real sort of, it's a fierce turf war. And the Times have just posted terrible figures, or sort of they've got a circulation decline of 8.5%, while the Journal is actually sort of slightly ticking up. I mean, I think generally it is seen that Les Hinton, Robert Thompson, and the Murdoch, you know, sort of ownership has been very beneficial to the Journal. It's really sort of felt that it's revivifying it over there. But of course, they can't let this pass without Robert Thompson, who's such a sort of a reasonable and urbane man, you know, for those familiar, those of us who knew him in his life, for his previous existence, but has become Rupert Murdoch's, you know, attack dog, has been really slagging off the Times, calling it, you know, social activist journalism, and saying that he said, if you want to be a social activist, join Amnesty International. He castigated them for being the journalistic elite. I mean, which is a cool tier. where to start with that one? And said, which he says has all the ossification of the traditional bourgeoisie.
Good, I mean, I don't even know what that means, John Plunkett.
It's going to be their new strapline, I think.
It's a good Scrabble
It is a good Scrabble score. The New York Times, all the ossification of, what was it?
The traditional bourgeoisie. Yeah. Ossification means like turning into a sort of, it's like ossify means turning into kind of, you know, bone or cut, yeah, you know, cut, Sorry, am I now being too professorial?
No, Professor Bell, you must, you know, Gunther, you're going to have to explain big words to young men in the future. It's the London strategy, isn't it? It's the strategy that Murdoch employed here in Britain. He's taking it, just exporting it to New York.
And the New York Times has responded in classic Murdoch fashion by giving away copies for free. So yes, there we are. He'll appreciate that tactic.
He will, yes. Now, in other news, Alan Yentob, John, BBC creative director, has been complaining, rather in the same way that those MPs have been complaining that they're not allowed to travel on first class on the trains now. He's complaining he's not allowed to turn left and go up front in the airplanes.
Well, he's gone on the offensive. Yeah, he was one of the more memorable expenses claims from the last round of BBC expenses disclosures was his business class trip from London to New York, which was £3,381.
Good Lord.
Courtesy of the licence fee payer. But he says he couldn't do his job if he didn't fly business class.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but last time I looked, I hadn't noticed that you had to fit the set of Imagine into a BA 747.
It was a busy trip. He went there, gave a talk in the morning. Right. He did some filming in the afternoon for Imagine. Flew back and was back at his desk the next day working. And says that he simply couldn't do it. And either you go business class or you don't go Yentob.
You know, in some ways, he is kind of right. I do know people who do this sort of thing who are not paid for by the public purse who say it is very, very difficult to do a day's work straight off a plane if you've travelled. You know, economy is not that difficult if you've stepped off a business class flight. Now, I know that sounds sort of terribly elitist. I think the problem with his argument is, as everybody knows, in the BBC, if you're a crew or a producer, you're quite often expected to work to the same schedule. I mean, I think here they may have had a crew sort of in situ already. Mm. You are expected to work straight off a plane
and sit down the back.
Yeah, exactly, and sit down the back. So whilst I think his overall proposition, you know, it's fairly unjustifiable and in the use of the public purse, it might be broadly right, but if it's broadly right, then the BBC are not adhering to it for all reasons.
Tut, tut.
For the rest of your workday, you won't hear this song again. So enjoy it while it lasts, or else don't come crying to me.
The no repeat guarantee.
Absolute Radio.
And after 18 months of legal action, Absolute Radio has settled its trademark fight with Absolute Vodka. So, John, we'll raise a glass to that. Rocks.
No more confusion between the two.
Well,
yes,
I mean, I was constantly going into my local off-licence coming out with the radio station.
yes, and absolute vodka is not necessarily the thing you want to wake up with first thing in the morning. No. So I think
Not every morning.
I think the winners here are the lawyers. Yeah, 18-month legal battle has finally come to an end. And neither side part of the deal is that it's a confidential agreement. So we don't know if that means Absolute Radio won't be going into areas that Absolute Vodka is dominant in or vice versa. Absolute Vodka won't now be launching a DAB radio station, perhaps.
I think it's fairly likely that that's not going to happen. Anyway, there we are.
Do with it.
Thank you very much, both of you, for those stories. Links to those, as ever, on guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Now, as this is our final media talk under this Labour government, and quite possibly any Labour government, let's go back to the election and take a broader look at the media's coverage of it so far. I mean, the big story, of course, Emily, has been the leaders' debates and how they have influenced all of the rest of the coverage and sucked the life out of the rest of the campaign. But also, they've transformed the campaign into something really interesting at the same time. So they've been terrible and good all at the same time, weirdly.
Yeah, I don't think they have been terrible at all. I mean, I think they've been wholly, wholly good. You know, if you imagine that the first live televised presidential debate in the States was in 1960 between Nixon and Kennedy, where very sort of famously Nixon had sort of come out of hospital, gone on air unshaven, a little bit underweight, not looking great. And it was sort of, you know, a really critical moment in that campaign. Anyone who sort of knows their political and sort of televised political history would have looked at that and actually sort of, here we are dragging our political system into the 20th century,
yes.
Kicking and screaming. And I think that Melvin Bragg was having a go this week at people's, at the political coverage of the mainstream channels, saying in general it's been lamentable. And what the leaders' debate has shown is that there is an appetite for engagement in long form political debates. I was talking to someone who's a sort of a head of a TV channel who was saying we had a sort of a side bet, if you like, on what the audience for the first debate would be. And they kind of undershot we both undershot, but they undershot more than I did. I think, you know, that this is, it's been really surprising. But I think the other thing that it's produced is actually, it's not just the appetite for it as, you know, long form journalism. It's actually the social media experience around it. So in other words, these things have become events, you know, that people have followed on Facebook. They've made jokes about it. They've kind of, you know, they've checked facts. They've sort of joined in with it as it's gone along, which is actually why sort of event television full stop, whether it's the X Factor or whether it's Britain's Got Talent or whether it's the Leaders' debates, are becoming really engaging sort of must-see things because of actually all the kind of social activity that goes on. But it's like watching football together now, isn't it? It's all the come round to your house, Matt.
I don't watch football match.
Can't go to the pub to watch the football now because they've got the election there, got the debate on. It's a disaster.
Well, this may happen in pubs in St Albans where you are.
Well, in 3D. I mean, it's hard to recall in previous election campaigns now what we actually used to, you know, clearly we remember what we spoke about, but what we kind of hung the coverage on, it because it's so centred now around the debates. As soon as one finishes, you're already thinking about, you know, the following Thursday. And I think it's sort of blown a hole in the effectiveness of party political broadcasts, which almost don't have I haven't seen a single one, and no one's really writing about them or talking about them.
And the thing with party political broadcasts, interestingly, is they're all being released on the internet and you watch them on YouTube.
But there is this thing as well, which is actually kind of, I think, sort of, there's a question mark about, I think, how the mainstream media have covered, particularly broadcast media, have covered the Lib Dems outside the live debates.
Right.
Because actually, kind of, I think that it's clear that the schedules for broadcasters were very clearly set ahead of the election, that, you know, their crews would be deployed to follow the main leadership candidates. And, it would be interesting to see, I mean, obviously with Gaffgate and things like that, Gordon has dominated this week. But it sort of slightly feels that outside the main debate, though the popularity of the Lib Dems has risen, you've not necessarily seen quite so much of them on the bullet. It does feel as though the sort of the massive broadcast machinery hasn't quite been able to accommodate for the change rapidly enough.
Mm. And I think the Lib Dems have struggled to accommodate the media interest in terms of, you know, right. The standing room only on their battle bus because they're expecting three hacks to following them.
The telephone booth.
That's right.
The morning press conference is on.
It's bulging.
it is true that in the first week of the campaign, the hacks that were on the Lib Dem battle bus had two seats to themselves. They were stretching out on the back, and they're all very angry now.
You know, I feel really ashamed. I sort of feel really ashamed that you have a three-party, you know, you have three parties and yet everything is run on a two-party system.
Mm. John, what about election night? Will you be, are you a fan of election night programmes? Will you be staying up? What time do you usually go to bed?
It's a very personal question.
And are you David Dimbleby or Alastair Stewart? Who's your...
I will be with Dimbleby, yeah. Yes. Yeah, I find Alastair Stewart makes me very tense. Always feels like he's struggling for the next breath. Yeah. But Emily was talking about the difficulty of switching from the two-party to the three-party system, but that's especially difficult if you're in charge of a TV swingometer.
Yes, because they don't swing three ways, do they?
Well, they do now on ITV.
You're coming to this. I think you'll find the Guardian swingometer swings three ways.
Can I just say that we had the first interactive 3D, I think we had a 3D swingometer last, a sort of three-way, but it did, it's a bugger to do. It really is.
It is.
Really hard. So you need to get some sort of PhD math students onto it.
Well, I think it was PhD math students that built it. John, you were just going to explain how ITV have solved the problem of the three-way swing.
Yeah, they got much excitement. Alistair Stewart, as you mentioned, with the assistance of Julie Etchingham. And they've got a huge graphics battleground, according to Etchingham. And by the looks of it, it looks a bit like Frankenstein's laboratory. And they've got these sort of big vats, I think, which fill up with sort of virtual coloured liquid. That's my take on it.
It's a knockout.
It's a knockout, yeah.
Is he wearing Stuart Hall?
You have to run from one side of the studio to the other without spinning the Lib Dem.
in a massive rubber suit,
yeah, that's
depicting
right.
David Cameron.
With Stuart Hall on the side.
Well, I'll definitely be watching
that. That's definitely how it's going to look.
Yeah. You're a BBC woman, but with the laptop on.
Oh, yeah, completely. I am.
Andrew Sparrow's Guardian Live blog.
You know, I'm multi-platform, yeah. Andrew Sparrow's Guardian Live blog of
election,
the election has been absolutely brilliant. It's the key source, not just for me, but I think for most of Westminster.
Hugh Edwards emailed to congratulate him yesterday.
Well, so he should do. Yeah. It's a very fine thing, but I love election night. Unfortunately, my husband is spending it with cabinet.
Another woman?
No, if only. No, it's with a cat. Sorry, cut that out. It's with a cabinet. With a cabinet,
cabinet member.
A cabinet member, I think. He said, he claims.
Gosh.
So I don't know. So I'm sort of going to be putting children to bed, I'm assuming, at sort of about 1 a.m. Mm.
I think the innovation of the election has been the ITV worm.
Oh, the wiggly worm. Oh, yes. That has me raging at the screen.
Does it?
It goes up when a politician speaks and goes down when they stop speaking. Thanks for that insight.
That's very good. Anyway, thank you very much. I should have plugged The Guardian's election night coverage, of course, guardian.co.uk/election2010, the aforementioned Andrew Sparrow at the helm. That's just about it. This week's podcast probably sounds as if it's been thrown together at the last minute, so no change there then. Except that the real reason is that producer Ben is absent this week because of a pressing and rather unexpectedly early appointment at the maternity ward. So congratulations to Ben and Emma, and hello to our newest listener, Noah Green. Leave your thoughts about this programme on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Make sure you subscribe for free while you're there so that every podcast gets automatically delivered to your iPod. Other MP3 players are available. Thanks to Emily Bell and to John Plunkett and to Gillian Duffy for giving us something to talk about. We'll see you next week. We've all said things we've later regretted.
Yeah.
You don't want to put a washer on a tumble dryer. I think you can put a tumble dryer on top of a washer. I think that's fine.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.